Last year, the city of Grants Pass made headlines all over the nation when the Supreme Court upheld the city's ban on homeless people sleeping in public places, including in parks, on sidewalks, and even in their own vehicles. But what didn't get as much attention is the problem of youth homelessness. Joining the exchange to help us learn more about efforts to address youth homelessness in Josephine County is Mary Farrell, Executive Director of the Maslow Project. Welcome, Mary.
Thanks for having me. Welcome.
Also joining the exchange is Andrea Bell. She's the Executive Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services, which has allocated $5 million to organizations in support of efforts to address youth homelessness in target regions. Welcome back to the exchange, Andrea.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. It's good to be back with you.
So, Mary, let's start with you. Give us a sense of the problem of youth homelessness in Josephine County.
Well, youth homelessness is a little different than what most people think when they try to picture that community. They tend to be very much an invisible population, meaning you're not going to necessarily drive down city centers or public parks and see a bunch of children hanging out. They tend to be more with their families than not with their families, kind of contrary to popular belief. Children experience homelessness roughly 10% of all students in public schools. So we're talking as early as, you know, infants, toddlers, preschoolers, all the way up through high school. So typically what you're looking at would be like a whole family that's experiencing homelessness. So we do have obviously teenagers who end up on their own as well. And they tend to be more camping or living in vehicles, couch surfing, sort of doubled up scenarios where they might be crashing with different family members or friends as they can. And they're really not looking to draw attention to themselves. They're really looking to fit in. So that's pretty much why you're not going to see them as much.
So how do you find them? What is the Maslow Project? Let's start there. And what service does
Maslow
it provide?
We're a local nonprofit here in Southern Oregon and serving Josephine and Jackson County. And we really are targeting youth where youth are. So we have multiple branches of our service delivery that are in our public schools. So kids are experiencing homelessness and they're in school. We're right there, sort of next to the guidance counselors, and they can just pop in and see us and get a variety of help. We also have a centralized resource center in both counties, and that's sort of a drop-in, come as you are, with a variety of help, which I'll go more into in a minute. And then we have like a street outreach effort, and that looks a little different in Josephine County than it does in Jackson County. We're really going out into more rural areas where kids might be camping or congregating with sort of various family members, friends. But we also do sort of look around in sort of common places like skate parks, the library, Starbucks, anywhere where we think we might be able to find youth. So it's sort of a multi-pronged approach of really finding these kids. But honestly, like most kids find us, we have a pretty robust messaging through social media, through sort of word of mouth, friends, referrals, things like that, schools. So it's sort of a combination. We find them, then they find us. And then we're really able to help provide a lot of intervention services. And that can be everything from sort of critical, you know, having clothing to wear to school is really important, especially when it's, you know, cold outside, having the right shoes, a jacket, school supplies, backpacks. Those are sort of the basics, but that's really what we offer just to sort of help stabilize these kids. And then we go way beyond that by providing comprehensive case management, which is sort of like a hybrid of, you know, we've got these sort of really well-trained social workers who are really adept at understanding sort of the teenage brain and youth and family dynamics, and they have a lot of education with sort of mental health service delivery, but they're able to offer those services in a very natural and comfortable environment. So, like, in other words, not clinical, and really, you know, trained to understand how to reach youth, particularly connect with them on goals related to enrolling in school, staying in school, graduating from school, because if kids can graduate high school, that's the number one predictor of being chronically homeless as an adult is a failure to graduate high school. So if we can really get upstream and prevent those youth from having prolonged traumas as a byproduct of being unhoused, get them through high school, and then get them on a path to whether it's some sort of career training or higher education, apprenticeship types of opportunities, really help build up their life skills and sort of teach them how to, you know, live as a as an adult in this world and navigate these different life challenges. That's really where the bulk of our efforts lie.
Well, you said that this population is relatively invisible, and you partner with public schools because you said 10% of public school students are usually fall into this category. What's the typical age, and how many schools are you partnered with?
Yeah, so roughly 10% of youth experience homelessness within our public school systems. And so that brings our average age to, from year to year it changes, but it's somewhere between 10 and 12 on any given year. So that really means we're averaging sort of those families with younger kids, and that can be pre-K, you know, K through six, with those families who have like older youth or youth who are on their own, teenagers, middle schoolers, high schoolers. So it's really all age groups. There is no age group that has more rates of homelessness than less. And I think that the reality is, like, you know, we work with five public schools, and it is the best way to capture those youth. I mean, the goal is to find those youth and stabilize them before they're having challenges with school, before they drop out, before there's behavioral issues, before there's too much missed education, and then they're falling behind their peers. So the goal is really to try to be where they are so that we can intervene and provide those stabilities and those supports early. And school's really the best place to do that. And we're very fortunate that our public schools here in Jackson, Josephine County allow us that privilege of having availability to their students, because I think a lot of districts around Oregon don't have those kinds of relationships.
Andrea, tell me about the funding provided by Oregon Housing and Community Services in support of efforts like Maslow Project, and what's the problem happening statewide?
Yeah, well, I think just as a starting point, the whole purpose of why the State Housing Agency exists here in Oregon is to make life better and make life more affordable for people across the state. And a big constraint that individuals, that families, that people face is the cost of housing and paying too much for housing, not having enough of it. And so as we have looked at and have really come to understand the realities of what that means for everyday life, that includes youth experiencing homelessness. And also when we think about the experiences of students, particularly K through 12, how important it is to have critical and specific investments to keep families from being unhoused and or experiencing homelessness. And so we were able to receive $5 million for this particular pilot, $5 million with the goal of working with Mary and her team at Maslow, but also four other partnering agencies across the state to really bolster those resources, school-based interventions with the goal of providing housing and housing services. From a statewide perspective, candidly, we could have had this be a statewide program, and it would have been not only necessary, but I think really effective. If you can think about just being a youth and being a student, how difficult that is just alone in and of itself. And then you add the added layer and dimension of experiencing houselessness. It is unfathomable to think that we would ask students to be students and have that level of restraint that nobody should be able to face. And so this is one of the clear and concrete ways that we as a state are beginning to put investments that are really focused on youth and students and stabilizing housing and their livelihood.
My guests today are Mary Farrell, Executive Director of the Maslow Project, and Andrea Bell, Executive Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services, which has allocated $5 million to support efforts to address youth homelessness in five target regions throughout Oregon. Andrea, what are those five target regions?
Yeah, so we have partners out in Coos County, Klamath, Lincoln, Douglas, and then, of course, Maslow Project and serving Josephine County.
So give us a sense of what the problem looks like as far as data.
Or yeah.
Is there any reliable data?
We do have reliable data. I think it's important to know a couple of things as we really try to equip ourselves with the truth. And I think those truths lies in, one, the quantitative data, which has helped us understand that the experience of single adult homelessness has increased over the last couple of years, even though we've put some real resources and are starting to see some progress through establishment of increasing shelter capacity and rapid rehousing and other important interventions, but also recognizing the qualitative piece, which is equally as important, which are the stories. People's lived experience and understanding the elements of that and where that plays a role in it. As we come to understand youth homelessness, we have in Oregon certainly seen an increase in youth experiencing homelessness, which indicates to us a couple of things. One, the criticality of boosting housing supply and making sure that we have continuous investment in housing supply across the state, particularly in small towns and rural communities. I think secondarily, how important it is to have a true safety net that can focus on family unification and family interventions on a proactive basis, not waiting till the issue happens to get there, but really seeing interventions and the reactive element being just as important as the proactive piece. And then I think the third piece, which really speaks to the qualitative piece, which are the people's experiences, is understanding what it looks like for youth that might be, when we think about people's individual experiences in terms of people being disabled, when we think about racial demographics, it's important that as we seek to make progress that we understand the totality of that issue and how that might be different for different people and put interventions in that are really reflective of that to help make sure that our investments aren't one size fits all, but are really targeted individual-based interventions.
I'm glad you brought that up, and we'll get back to that. Mary, we have a couple of minutes before we have to take a quick break. What's the best case scenario for an unhoused young person in distress? How quickly can they find assistance and get established with a stable lifestyle? I heard family reunification. Andrea mentioned that. How does that happen?
Yeah, I mean, first, I just want to sort of reiterate that we both have young people experiencing homelessness who are still with their family, and the whole family is experiencing homelessness, and then we have young people who are separated from their family for a variety of reasons, usually related to some form of trauma or family breakdown. But the good news is that help is readily available, almost instantaneous. So we are fortunate enough, like I said earlier, to be able to be in a multitude of places. We're out in the community, we're in schools, and we're sort of intertwined with a variety of other public resources. And so if youth know to find us, or if we know to find them, we can connect, you know, same day and immediately start to provide some supports and safety net services. And frankly, you know, that is a daily occurrence. You know, kids will just walk into our office in schools and say, here's what happened last night. And we're just there right away. And so there's a really quick response, which is great, because the longer that youth experience homelessness, the more traumas that they're experiencing, the more traumas that they're witnessing. You know, youth go hungry at twice the rate of their housed peers. They have, you know, seven times more likely to actually attempt suicide. So the mental health risk factors go up significantly every day that they are out on the streets, and they're way more likely to be exposed to trafficking or exploitation. I think the statistic is something like within 72 hours, a youth is like, you know, I think it's like 50% more likely to be, you know, sexually trafficked or exploited than their housed peers. So that's why early intervention is key, and we are able to provide that.
Andrea, the issue of youth homelessness intersects with many other issues like you spoke of before the break. like unemployment, income, housing, education, food, physical and mental health. Without a stable parent leading the way, how do Oregon youth navigate such a challenging course?
Well, I think you are right. And both at a policy level, that is why the policymaking process is so important. But, you know, people have understood this in their lives for far too long and have understood this in real ways. Often before the system has been able to come and really work in an integrated and holistic form. You know, candidly, one of the most effective ways here in Oregon that we have been able to see progress, whether it's on the youth side or adult side, but really measurable and sustainable progress, is for the state to understand where we need to be out in front and where we maybe need to invest in the solutions locally. And what I mean by that is, if the state were to directly administer a youth experiencing homelessness program or some other program as a means to offer direct intervention, sometimes that's appropriate and that's effective. But oftentimes we rely on, and it's important that we also listen and learn and rely on partners locally that know their community best and know how to facilitate the conditions and circumstances for progress. And so I think as part of the way forward, we are really focused on not only getting more money and setting good policy for some of these important things that are going to make life better for people through housing, but really making sure that we're focused on localized interventions and relying on partners in those communities to help really make that happen and hold the state accountable for supporting such endeavors.
So, Mary, to that point, what role do schools and government agencies play in assisting the Maslow Project?
Well, I mean, they're one of our key partners. I don't think any of us can do this work by ourselves. I know it sounds, I guess, you know, lofty to just talk about partnerships, but the reality is, you know, people, individuals, whether they're adults or children, are never just who they are at any point in time. They're a whole person, and education and housing and healthcare and other aspects of life are all part of what people need. So to have partnerships that allow, you know, educators to focus on what they do best, and that's education, and allow housing providers and developers to do what they do best, and that's build housing and manage housing and healthcare provide, you know, et cetera. So where we can come in is connect the dots between all these different partners and help these children and these families navigate the system in a way that's really focused on and tailored to their goals. So I think of those partnerships are key. They're also obviously funders of a lot of the work. And so to give us that sort of local flexibility of catering the funds to meet the needs of a local community is really brilliant. And I'm, you know, grateful that that's an opportunity that we have. We couldn't do it without either the resources or the collaboration. And that's just true.
Well, it sounds like there's a lot of collaboration that must take place, a lot of networking, a lot of communication. I'm trying to find what's the trend. Give me some numbers, Andrea. Across the state, are the numbers of youth, unhoused youth, growing? Is it the same or is it getting worse over the past 5-10 years? What do those numbers look like?
Yeah. Well, we will have more current data that will be shared out recently. But I think when we step back and look at the trend, let's just say over the last half a decade, from a statewide perspective, but also I think from a national perspective, we've continued to see increases. We've continued to see increases in youth experiencing homelessness, particularly when we look at the McKinney-Vento data, which we rely on as a data collection means within the school. We've continued to see some of those trends increase. It doesn't mean that we haven't seen progress in other areas, but directionally, we've continued to see increases. And so as we have been attentive to that data and really sought to understand it, there's a few things that come up for me, which is one is being attentive to the difference within and between subpopulations of people that are experiencing homelessness. From an economic perspective, even though the last couple of years we have seen incomes increase, we've seen the cost of everything explode from goods to services. That has a real impact in day-to-day lives and people having to make tough decisions about what's going to get paid and what isn't going to get paid. And then the other thing that I would also say is, as part of that, is this is also an endeavor where we need federal, state, and local working in coordination and working with the same scale of urgency to really make the sustainable progress that youth deserve, that young adults deserve, and that is going to be in front of us to confront not part of the solution, but the whole of it.
My guests are Mary Farrell, Executive Director of the Maslow Project, and Andrea Bell, Executive Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services. We're talking about the issue of youth homelessness statewide and what's being done about it in Josephine County. So, Mary, same question to you. As far as a timeline is concerned, 5-10 years, what's the data look like here locally for the Maslow Project? What are the numbers?
Yeah, I mean, locally in Josephine County, we have seen a range over the last 5 years between 600 school-aged youth experiencing homelessness and 800 between the two school districts in Josephine County. The reason for that number fluctuation is typically because of mobility of these families and these youth. So going between school districts, going between counties even, there's really high mobility in the unhoused youth population. But that's a really high number, and it typically shocks people because, again, they're not just driving down the street and seeing all these kids experiencing homelessness. I mean, it is an invisible population, but that number fluctuates throughout the year as well. Sometimes kids are experiencing homelessness for a short period of time, which is optimal. If they have to be in that situation at all, we want to have as least number of days as possible. And sometimes it's really a kind of a long-term scenario where families just have a lot of barriers and it takes a while. So those numbers can fluctuate really between 600-800, but that's been the trend. And if anything, I think, you know, on a larger scale in Southern Oregon as a region, we've seen the numbers spike in certain communities and then kind of go back down and spike in other communities, but roughly staying around the 3,000 mark of Jackson and Josephine County put together. And that's a really huge number.
And when you talk about spiking in certain communities, are there demographics to those communities?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of what drove some of the spike is our fires that we experienced here in Southern Oregon in 2020. And so we would see, you know, kind of a surge in unhoused families in sort of the Phoenix Talent region. And then as those families relocated or left the area or got rehoused or stabilized, then those numbers went back down. And then, you know, you've got the cost of rent increasing and a lot of families, you know, unable to find housing in other communities that they have historically lived in. And so sort of being pushed out, if you will, from just being able to afford housing in their kind of home communities. And I think that that's part of what drives the mobility and a lot of them going out into more rural regions, to be honest.
Andrea, same question to you. What kind of spikes are you seeing and what are the demographics related to those spikes?
Yeah, I think one of the trends that we have continued to see across multiple experiences of homelessness is not only just a volume increase, but when we look at that disaggregated by data, that we do tend to see Indigenous and Black and Brown communities tend to be overrepresented, and that's in multiple dimensions across the housing and the homelessness system. The reason why I think that is such an important truth to make sure that we understand is whether you work in housing directly yourself or you're a neighbor or you're somebody just watching your community change and you care and you want to do something about it, it's important that we come from a place of truth and transparency to know what we are working with. And from our perspective, you know, we don't accept homelessness as a fact of life that has to be. And that also means that we've got to wrestle with some truth so that as we look to make more investments and make sound policy and partner with agencies to make progress, that we understand what the barometer for progress is beyond just decreasing of the numbers, which is critically important, but also making sure that that progress is felt across communities. Because if we don't do that, then we're not really making the progress that we seek to make in lowering that ceiling for the potential that is incumbent upon all of us as people helping to move the system forward.
So, Mary, that's a good point. I know that here in Southern Oregon, largely a white community, 90% plus, but are you seeing a lot of spikes in youth homelessness among kids of color and Spanish-speaking populations? And if so, how are you addressing that to ensure that they have the services and the communication folks that they need?
Yeah, that's a great question. I would say I would not define it as a spike. I would characterize it more as a steady trend. Over the last 5 years, we've seen our population of Spanish-speaking families, for example, and youth grow significantly. And I would say if you kind of put every non-white demographic of population we serve into a percentage, that's now about 45%. So we have about 55% of our total families and youth who identify as white, and about 45% who identify as anything other than white. And so our response to that has been to really increase our service delivery with bilingual, bicultural. About a third of our employees are Spanish-speaking, bicultural, bilingual. And that has really helped us really outreach more to the families and the youth who need those services who might not have otherwise engaged with us. And I'm really glad that we've been able to try to keep pace with that growth.
Help me understand some of the costs that are involved in the work you do. Talk about your annual budget.
Yeah, we sit at around $3.5 million. And the reality is the bulk of most social service agencies' budgets really is in services and programs. And that is true for us as well. So the vast majority of our costs would be in our FTE, and those would be our providers. These are qualified mental health associates, caseworkers who are, you know, really doing the frontline work. And then we also have a kind of growing budget, thanks to the partnership with Oregon Housing Community Services is a great example, to be able to provide this sort of assistance, this direct level of assistance with deposits and helping people remove barriers to housing, help them with rental assistance while they're getting on their feet and sort of acclimating to being housed and managing that going forward. So a huge chunk of our budget, over $500,000, is for direct assistance to those that we serve, which is really fortunate. And then, of course, you have your sort of administration overhead, and our agency has been fortunate to be able to keep those costs really minimal, partly because we partner with public schools, and so that provides, you know, a space resource for us that keeps kind of our overhead down. But yeah, I think being able to provide that direct assistance to the population we serve is one of the most meaningful ways that our budget helps our community.
Andrea, we have less than a minute left, but I want to give you the same question. What's the budget, and if you had the budget you dream of, what would that look like?
Ooh, that's a really great question, Mike. Well, across state and federal resources, we are, of course, administering at any moment several million dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars towards boosting supply, homeownership opportunities, homelessness, climate, energy, all of the things that are really central to housing in all of its forms and making it more affordable and more accessible to folks. I think the changes around this are tectonic, and I think it's also important to for this moment to pull from a place of hope and optimism, and that we will need the federal government to continue acknowledging homelessness and housing as a critical need for the progress of our state and as our nation, and to make sure that policies put forth help move the people we serve forward in real ways.
Unfortunately, that's all the time we have. Thank you, Andrea.
Thank you.
And thank you, Mary.
Thanks for having us.